And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Jim M. from Alpine.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim McElwee. My friends call me Jimmy Mac. My sobriety date's March 10th, 1993. I have a home group. It's La Mesa Men's Group. Friday night stag meets at this meeting actually starts, the meeting before the meeting starts at 6 on a Friday and goes until 11 o'clock usually. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this program. It saved my life. I want to thank Larry for asking me to come and share my story with you tonight. Hope I don't put too many people to sleep. Larry, I've known Larry since I first got sober. He was one of my early mentors in the program and still mentors me in a lot of ways. Larry and I shared something else in common other than just alcoholism. When we were kids, we both raised pigeons. And I'm a native San Diegan, born and raised here. Born at Paradise Valley Hospital, February 7th, 1950. And I grew up just around the corner down at Redwood Village on the corner of Redwood and 60th Street. And I used to have to go to La Paloma Pet Store to get my pet food. Every Saturday I'd walk down there. It was about a mile and a half from my house. And it was on 47th and Federal. And Larry used to get his pigeon food there as well. And I was a surfer dude, so I always wore my Smileys and my Levi cords, my Madras shirts. And whenever I'd turn the corner on Euclid and 47th, there'd always be a group of black kids, and they'd chase me. And I got to be pretty fast. They usually didn't catch me. But one time they did, and it scared the living daylights out of me. I didn't know what to do. And three of them, and one of them saw that I was shaking in my boots, and he came up and he said, "Hey, the guy's shaking his boots. Leave the kid alone." They let me go. I swear to God, that was Larry Dixon, but he denies it to this day, but I know it was him. You know, I didn't set out to be an alcoholic. I, too, went to Catholic school. My parents were very religious. My family was very poor. There were six kids. We lived in a two-bedroom, one-bath house. There was four girls and two boys. And and times were tough. My parents felt the best they could do is give us a Catholic education because they felt that would give us a good start on life. And from the time I was little, I always felt different than everybody else around me because everybody else had normal parents, normal houses, you know, two kids, two cats and a dog, and parents made good money. We lived in an affluent neighborhood even though we were poor. And I just never felt like I fit in. I always felt different. And so I kind of hung out. I kind of hid out and scared of my own shadow. When I was 13 years old, it was when I took my first drink of alcohol. And I was given the job of chaperoning my sister Mary. There was a CYO dance up at Colina del Sol Park. And her boyfriend was a member of the band. And so my parents felt it would be okay if she went as long as she was chaperoned by her 13-year-old brother. So I went to the dance, and my friend Jose Medina and I decided to drink some alcohol before the dance. So I chugged two tall Colt 45s, and all of a sudden, the world was magical. You know, I came alive. I could talk to the girls. I danced every dance. I left there 3.5 hours later, dripping wet from head to toe, with the crotch of my pants split out from doing the splits. And I was immediately obsessed with alcohol. It was the first time in my life that I felt normal. I felt like I fit in. I felt like there was nobody was judging me. There was no difference between you and me, and the world was right. And there was three dances a week, so three times a week, that's what I did. I soon went to change from Colt 45 because that was too. I only weighed about 125 pounds at the time, and that was a lot of liquid to consume, so I started drinking Southern Comfort. And a half a pint, if I chugged a half a pint of Southern Comfort and ate a pack of Sensens, I could get through the door guard before, you know, I had to walk a line to do a sobriety checkpoint even when we were kids. And if I chugged it and then took my pack of Sense Ends, I could get through the line. And then when I got in the dance floor, all of a sudden it'd kick in, and I was off and running. And that was the start of my alcoholism. Alcohol was the only thing that made everything okay. It made all those differences, the fact that my family was poor, the fact that people had more stuff than me, made all that stuff just go away. It made me laugh. It made me funny. I could talk to the girls. It was magic. I got my first job when I was 14, working at Frank's Texaco on the corner of 54th and Redwood. And I closed the store four nights a week. So four nights a week, my friend worked at Lou's Liquor House. I could go over and get my booze and put it in the lube bay. And back then, we used to mop down the lube bays and hose them into the storm drain and squeegee them off. So 4 days a week, I'd get drunk. My parents would usually be in bed asleep by the time I got home, so I never got caught. So it worked really good. You know, alcohol worked. It was a solution to all my problems. I couldn't do friendships because every time I get in a friendship, in the back of my mind, I would think, you know, if they really knew what I was like and who I was, they wouldn't want anything to do with me. And whenever there would be two or more people involved, there was a triad, I always felt like they were conspiring against me. It was just stuff going on in my brain. It probably wasn't true, or maybe it was, I don't know. But alcohol made all that go away. I got kicked out of my house when I was 17 years old because my parents caught on to the fact that I was drinking. And that was great because it gave me the opportunity to drink every day. So from the time I was 17 until I got sober in 1993, that's when I did. I became a daily drinker. But because I was brought up Catholic and because my parents instilled some sort of values in me, I wasn't a bum. You know, I went to work all the time. I had to be self-supporting. So I'm not a convict. I didn't do a lot of things that a lot of people had to do to get their seat here. I always maintained a job. And because of that, I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I got up and went to work every day and maintained a job. I couldn't be an alcoholic. Alcoholics push shopping carts with brown bags and live underneath bridges. And the only alcoholic I knew when I was a kid growing up was a guy named Ted who lived down the street that at 40 years old was still living at home with his parents. He was a contractor. When he was doing good, he was doing really good. When he was doing bad, he was bumming money off all the kids in the neighborhood. He was just a pathetic drunk. And I wasn't like Ted, so I couldn't be an alcoholic. But I was. So, 18, I got my first wife pregnant. I had my first child when I was 19 years old. Some of the people in this room know my first child. She happens to be one of us. Apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I was given... life wasn't good. I had a lot of responsibility. I was scared to death. Didn't know what to do. I ran by drinking. I ran from life by drinking. That's just what would work for me. So we had another child, John, my son John. He was born in 1973. 6 months after he was born, my wife gave me an ultimatum. Either stop drinking and doing your other issues, or get out of the house. I'm not going to live like this way. And I'm not going to have the kids subjected to this kind of behavior. I said, I'll take the car and the stereo, and I left. I walked out on that relationship because I felt that I'd been cheated out of life. I never got to go out and do the college thing, never had to have girlfriends. That was my high school. We were both cheerleaders in high school. That was my high school sweetheart. And I felt I was cheated, so I was going to go out and make my mark in the world. So I set out. Disco was just hitting the scene in San Diego. I became a disco model. I modeled. I had an afro, a Fu Manchu, Angel Flight slacks, platform shoes, Don Manuel's signature polyester shirts. They make you stink like you wouldn't believe after a night of dancing. But that was the era. So Tuesday night, I danced at the Odyssey in down off West Point Loma. And Thursday night, I danced at a club called the Oz. It was on the top of National University in Mission Valley and got free clothes for doing my thing. At that time, powdered alcohol was popular too, so I did a lot of powdered alcohol along with my liquid alcohol so I could drink more and fit in. And that just became a lifestyle for me, and I loved everything about it. I loved the strobe lights and the dancing, and the life was good. You know, times were easy. I had lots of girlfriends every night. I'd have a new girlfriend. And I thought that's what it was supposed to be. I thought that was the deal, you know. That was all there was to life. I was dating a gal who was a model for head shampoo at the time, and I was really, really in love with this gal. And so I asked her if she wanted to get serious and get engaged, and she said, no, you have a false sense of values. And that just crushed me. I have a false sense of values. What are you talking about? You know, I got it going on. About that time, Johnny Cash had a song out. It was called Welfare Cadillac. It was about a guy that drove around in a Cadillac with nice clothes but didn't have a pot to piss in. And that's how I lived. I lived paycheck to paycheck. I looked good because I had the clothes and I had a Camaro. And I thought that was all I needed to get life going. I thought I was looking good. So I ended up wrecking that Camaro. Drove it over the side of Del Diaz Highway. I called up my insurance company, Geico, and told them I swerved to avoid hitting a dog, and they fixed the car. A month later, I was down at, it used to be Big Eddie's. It's in Cahoots now. And I didn't score that night. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was leaving the club. I was drunk out of my gourds. And they used to have a parking booth when you came into the parking lot for daytime parking tickets. And somebody was talking to a girl outside of the club, and it really made me angry because he had connected and I hadn't. So I gunned my car to pass him and ran right into the parking post in the middle and drove the point of the Camaro into the radiator shroud, and everybody up on top was laughing. Ha, 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 look at this guy. So I wrecked the car again and hurt myself in the process. And when I was laying in bed recovering from that, a commercial came on, Volvo, the world's safest engineered car. I went out and bought a Volvo. Figured if I'm gonna drink and drive, I gotta have a safer car. Never occurred to me to stop drinking, but my life just started spiraling. You know, I had a good job. I worked for Steiner Corporation. I was their top salesperson. So at that time, I was making really good money, and life was good. But I didn't have anything to show for it, and I got passed up for promotion. So my best thinking said, screw you, I'm going to go out and get another job. Well, that was when Carter was president. You know, interest rates were 20%, unemployment was 17%. 1978, it wasn't a good time to be unemployed. We had odd-even gas rationing. I mean, it just wasn't a good time. So I ended up hitting the bottom. You know, that powdered alcohol and liquid alcohol combined took me to a place I didn't want to be. So my best thinking was to go max out my credit cards, buy a new wardrobe, and declare bankruptcy. And that's what I did, and I moved into a garage in Ocean Beach that I paid $25 a month for, and the OB control tower was my shower, cold showers every morning. That's where alcohol took me. But I didn't think it was that bad, you know. I still had a garage. I actually would still go out clubbing, and I'd bring girls home to that garage, so I thought everything was cool. You know, the strangest thing is they came home with me. A friend of mine at that time, we were having a conversation about how smart we were, and I was bragging about how smart I was. Now, I'm living in a garage in Ocean Beach. I don't have a pot to piss in. I got a part-time job, a 10-speed bicycle, and a few clothes and a waterbed to keep me warm at night. And he's going, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? And he just floored me. You know, I had to stop and think. You know, he's got a point there. If I'm so smart, why aren't I rich? So that started me on a whole new venture. I kind of picked myself up by the bootstraps, and I started my business and kind of pulled myself together for a little while and set out to make my fortune. Because in the back of my mind, even when I was a kid, it seemed like the boy with the most toys always won. So that set me on a new quest to start accumulating toys and wealth, and that's what I did. And 1981, I met my wife. She's here tonight, so I can't lie. I was still doing powdered alcohol and liquid alcohol in the extreme. But I had a successful business, and I was up and coming, so you just stay out of the way. Everything's fine. Thank you very much. And we started dating, and she moved in, and a couple years later I asked her to marry me, and she said no because of my powdered alcohol affliction. And so I had to stop doing that, and I switched from one form of powder to a different form of powder so that I could get away with it. And we got married, and I was a daily drinker. I drank myself to sleep every night. I'd go to work. I'd get up early in the morning. I'd work hard to get my business going. And my business was successful. I went from having a small shop with a couple of employees to having 300 employees in a big shop. And life seemed to be good. But alcohol had ceased to work for me. It was no longer something that I could. I didn't have a choice in whether I was going to drink. It was when I was going to run out. That was the only choice that I had. When was I going to pass out, or when was I going to run out? And I drink myself to sleep every night. And I had all the stuff, all that stuff that I always thought would make me happy, that would fill that hole in my soul. And it didn't. You know, somehow wanting it and getting it and having it were two different things. And I would wake up and I'd go, I can't live like this. I can't do this anymore. And I was completely powerless about doing anything about it. I'd swear I wasn't going to drink or do anything that day, and by 10 o'clock, I'd be off and running again. And I'd drink myself to sleep every night. And we managed to have a couple of children. My son Brian's with us tonight. He was born in 88. When my son Brian was born, other people that we hung around with at the time got married and started having families too. And their husbands stopped drinking. Like I drank. They didn't drink every day. They might drink at a football game on Sunday or do something like that, but they weren't doing what I was doing every day. And my wife had this fantasy that I would grow up, you know, that things would be different, that I would stop drinking. She didn't know that I was an alcoholic and I was powerless over doing anything about it. I didn't know I was an alcoholic and I was powerless about it because I was still functioning, or so I thought I was. 3 years later, my son Timmy was born, and it was getting worse. I was getting more and more depressed, more and more lonely. I'd come home from work. I'd give the obligatory hug to the wife, play with the kids for 5 minutes. I'd go isolate in the back room. They'd live in one part of the house, and I lived in the other part of the house. And I was just dying inside. And as a result, I was killing everything around me, all the people that loved me, my wife, my kids, my parents, my siblings. They were all watching the shipwreck. They were all aware of what was going on long before I was. And I was powerless over doing anything about it. My wife had a bright idea. She decided that we'd go to a marriage counselor, that if we went to a marriage counselor, he'd straighten us out and I would change. I would see the errors of my ways. So we went to a marriage counselor, and he asked me if I drank, and I said, yeah. He says, well, how much do you drink? And I said, a couple. He said, well, can you cut down to maybe one a day? And I said, sure. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you know, one-fifth, you know, one case. I can play this game. And so I never had any intention of doing anything about the drinking because I couldn't. I was powerless over doing it. So I just changed my routine. And we went to three sessions. Finally, the third session, he says, you know, I can't do anything for you. He gave me a yellow slip of paper, and it was to check into a rehab. He says, why don't you fill out this form of paper and go check into this rehab, and maybe after you go there for a while, we can talk about working on your marriage relationship. And I was offended. I was really upset. And I didn't realize it, but he had been talking to Christy about going to Al-Anon at that point in time and getting involved with something else because she needed something to take care of herself and not obsess on the alcoholic. And so we walked out, and she thought I was going to check in, go downstairs and check in that day. And I was angry. I was really pissed. I said, no, we're out of here. So I grabbed the paper, and I said, I'll fill this out later. We went home. And she got involved with her Al-Anon program. And 3 months later, the paper was still sitting on my dresser. Nothing had changed. But she had gotten some strength because of Al-Anon and the gals that she had come in contact with. And those gals loved her because she wasn't getting any love at home. and they gave her the courage and conviction that she could do something about the situation for herself, not for the alcoholic, but for herself. And so finally, one day, I was doing my regular routine. I'd do my powdered alcohol first thing in the morning in my coffee, and then I'd do my herbal alcohol at 9 o'clock, and then I'd start my liquid alcohol at 10 o'clock. And she called up my daughter that night before, and was just talking to Natalie, because Natalie was concerned about me too. And Natalie says, "Well, do you think he's doing powdered alcohol?" And she goes, "Oh, no, he quit doing that when we got married." This is 1993. We got married in 85. And she goes, "Well, this is where you need to go look." And so I come out of the shower at 5 o'clock in the morning, and my wife's standing in the kitchen, and she's shaking a bag of powdered alcohol, saying, "What's this?" "Nothing." Grabbed it, and the gig was up. I knew the gig was up. I knew I stood to lose everything at that point. And yet I was powerless about doing anything about it. Completely powerless. She went to her Al-Anon meeting. We talked. I got rid of the stuff and told her I would quit doing it because I knew the gig was up. So that weekend I slept the whole weekend, slept all the way through Monday. Got up, and she insisted that I go to a program. So I went and checked myself into rehab, and I signed a permission slip so she could call the rehab place because she wanted to verify that I had gone there. And went and saw the therapist, and she asked me if I could stop drinking. I said, "Yeah, I can quit. You know, it's not that big a deal." It had been, after all, it had been 3 days. And she goes, "Okay, well, maybe if you can quit, you know, come back in 30 days, maybe you don't need this program." So I left, and I came home. I told my wife what happened. She said, "What did the therapist say?" She said, "I don't need to be here. If I can quit in 30 days, I can come back, and everything will be fine." And Christy was just livid. She called up the therapist, and that therapist wasn't available, but her therapist was, and she went and looked at the file. I didn't know they could do that stuff, but apparently they did in this situation. The other therapist had just written ambivalent across the form and kind of discarded it. And so I'm going along. Wednesday, I come home early from work, and my wife's getting ready to go to a meeting, and I pull in the driveway behind her, and I'm going to take her to lunch. I'm starting to feel pretty good. It's been 6 days now. I haven't had anything in my system. I'm starting to feel somewhat normal. I actually have a smile on my face. And I walk up, and I say, "Hey, let's go to lunch." She goes, "I'm going to my meeting. I'm not going to lunch with you." I said, "Oh, don't go to your meeting. You don't need to go to that meeting. Let's go to lunch. Let's go have some fun. Get your stuff and get out of the house. You've made your decision. I'm not going to subject my kids to this kind of lifestyle. I'm not going to live this way. I'm not going to subject the kids to this. You've made your decision. Now get out." I said, "Well, I'm not leaving." And we got in a big argument. And I finally said, "Okay, what do you want me to do?" She said, "Get yourself into a rehab." And so I said, "Okay." She opened the car door and drove me down. Sat in on the next meeting with the next therapist. And she wasn't going to let me lie my way through that scenario again. And that's what started my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come here with a joyful heart. You know, alcohol had been the only thing that made my life seem normal from the time I was 13 years old. As bad as it was when I was 43, it was still my only tool for coping with life. It was still the only, no matter how miserable I was, it was still the only thing that made me feel normal. And she's asking me to cut off my right arm to stay in the relationship. And it was hard. And I didn't like my wife. I hated her. She knew what she got when she's married me. What is she trying to change me now? And that's what I confronted her with. And and I hate to say this because it's really hurtful, but it's part of my story. The only thing that kept me in that relationship at that point in time was the fact that I was afraid of losing all that stuff. because that belief that I had that the boy with the most toys wins, I had all the toys. We had a nice house in Del Cerro, had two new cars, two cats, two kids, two dogs. I have more toys even to this day than most people dream of having. And I didn't want to lose the stuff. It wasn't because I loved my wife. It's because I'd gone through a divorce once before and taken the car and the stereo and left the house and everything else behind. I didn't want to go through that. I didn't want to be bankrupt. And so I stayed in that relationship. The first year in recovery was pure hell on both of us. More so on my wife, my poor wife, than on me. And because I wasn't doing the program. I was going to meetings. I was doing what I was told to do, the bare minimum. I'd walk into the meetings, and the first meetings I went to, I heard people quote page 440, you know, Dr. Paul's story, the chapter on acceptance in the third edition, 448. And, you know, read page 86, 87, and 88. Upon awakening and the promises, you know, page 83 and 84, and the doctor's opinion. And I knew what quotes people said, that everybody would come up to him after the meeting and pat him on the back and say, oh, boo-boo, what a good job you did. And they look good, and I wanted to look good in AA, so I memorized all the stuff that I needed to memorize so that when I was asked to share, I could get up in front of the podium and I could look good in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the minute I'd leave that room and I'd head home, I'd just turn back into instant a-hole. I was mean to my wife, mean to the kids, just totally miserable. There was no spirituality in my life. And what happened was at the end of the year, I didn't get that sheepskin. You know, I really thought that at the end of the year I would graduate from the program. They'd give me a diploma and I could get on with my life. Maybe I could do some controlled drinking and things would be different. The heat would be off. My wife would be okay with me having a few drinks every now and then. And what happened was at the end of that year, I didn't get a sheepskin. And my life was as miserable as it was the first day I walked into the program. Nothing had changed. I was just a dry drunk, white-knuckling sobriety, not doing anything about it. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that this wasn't a one-year proposition. This was a lifelong proposition. And I actually read the big book. You know, I'd breezed through it just for those quotes before, but I never really read it. And I actually got a sponsor. You know, I talked about, again, I had a sponsor the first 6 months in the program. I got a sponsor, but it was just in name only. I handpicked this person because they wouldn't call me on any behavior. I actually got a sponsor that worked the program that had a sponsor. And we got into the book and started doing the program. And nothing was changing. I wasn't experiencing the promises. You know, I wasn't... Of course, I hadn't done the ninth step yet, but you know, all that stuff that they talked about in the early chapters of the book just wasn't happening for me. I wasn't happy, joyous, and free. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And but I kept going to meetings. I kept doing the deal because I just watched other people, and I'd see people in meetings that were happy. You know, Larry was one of them, and one of my old friends, Ted H., who's passed away, and Billy O'Brien, who's passed away, and Hugh McCoy, who's passed away, Marshall, and lots of guys that I hung around with that were my early mentors. They had something that I wanted, but I had no clue on how they got it. Now, I'd watch what they do, but I didn't watch them. I'd watch them in the meetings. I didn't watch them outside of the meetings. I didn't know that they actually practiced these principles in all their affairs, that they carried that program that they talked about inside the rooms out into the real world, that they actually made amends when they did a wrong to somebody. And they actually were of service to their fellow man, asking nothing in return. And that they actually loved their wives and did things that were foreign to me. I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. Nobody ever taught me. And I was 4 years sober. We went on a vacation. I got to get sober here pretty quick. I got to tell you, this program, I love AA, and this program does work. We went on this vacation, and I was starting to get some of the stuff in the program. I had a couple of sponsees, and I was starting to feel pretty good some of the time, but not all the time. I still wasn't practicing these principles in all my affairs. I knew what the steps were, but I didn't know how they applied in my daily life. And I went on this vacation. I had this trip planned out. And the year before, I'd taken the boys on a hiking trip, and we did this 3-mile hike down to the Boy Scout camp from Lodgepole up at Sequoia. And so this next year, I planned we're going to march Mount Baldy Saddle. We're going to go to Crystal Cave. We're going to do all these wonderful things. And I planned a trip at Magic Mountain, 2 days in the hotel, and you know, early tickets. And in the last part of the leg of the trip was going to be Disneyland, 3 nights in the Disneyland hotel, and had all this stuff planned out. We get up to Sequoia. The kids don't want to go hiking. The year before, we ended up the trip at Hume Lake, which is a little Christian lake down in Kings Canyon. They wanted to go to the lake. They didn't want to go hiking. I just threw a tizzy fit. If you're not going to do what I want to do, then if I'm going to be miserable, you're going to be miserable. And I made their life miserable that first day on that camping trip. Finally, I settled down. We went on the thing, and we actually had a pretty nice rest of the 2 weeks we were in Sequoia. We get to Magic Mountain. I'm going to take the kids on the, you know, they're older now, so they'll appreciate roller coasters. And they just opened up Splash Mountain, so Timmy didn't want to go. He wanted to go to Splash Mountain. So Christy took Timmy to Splash Mountain, and I took my son Brian to Magic Mountain. And the first ride I took him on was Viper, first car. And he was like 7 years old, scared the... He came off that ride in tears and didn't want to go on any more roller coasters. And I was pissed. I was so pissed. You know, I bought these passes, special passes, so we could get in there. So anyway, we leave the. I couldn't get him to go on even the kiddie roller coasters after that. So we went to Splash Mountain and played in the water park and had a wonderful time the next 2 days. The third day, we go down to Disneyland, and I have special passes. We're staying at the Disneyland Hotel, and in the old park, before they did the new one, when you walk, we had a camper trailer we were towing. We had to park in a special lot, and when you first walked in, there was a RC radio-controlled car track, and then there was a moat in the middle with these radio-controlled tugboats that you could operate, and then in the middle of the moat, there was an arcade with those little one-armed bandits you can pick the toys up with. And we took the kids to the arcade, and they just, that's all they wanted to do was get those little toys, you know, put the money in the claw and pick up these toys. So there goes Disneyland. They don't want to go to the park. They want to go to the arcade. I'm just livid. I have reservations at the Blue Bayou, Pirates of the Caribbean restaurant for dinner. Brian gets sick, so we can't have dinner at the Blue Bayou. Just miserable. And if I'm going to be miserable, guess what? And we get home, and the ride home was just unbearable for everybody. And we get in the door, and the first thing Christy does is she calls her sponsor. And I did what every good alcoholic does that's in his disease, is I stand outside the door and eavesdrop on her conversation. And she's telling her sponsor, I can't live with this guy. He's crazier now than he was when he was drinking. I can't live like this. I have to leave him. What I heard was that she was going to leave me after all I've done. After all I've done for her, getting in the program and not drinking for 4 years, she's going to leave me. And what happened was it became real. It became real that I could no longer live the life that I was living and act like, you know, allegedly be in a program of recovery and not work the steps and practice these principles in all my affairs. And what happened was all of a sudden I changed sponsors. I got a sponsor that meant business. And Peter Fleischman was my sponsor for 11 years. He passed away last year. And Peter said, well, first thing he told me was, we need to get busy. Now, I've already been in the program for 4.5 years now. What do you mean we need to get busy? And we started reading the book together. And we started doing the steps. And the steps came alive for me. You know, the first step is that, you know, I'm an alcoholic. My life's unmanageable. I'm an alcoholic. My life's unmanageable. My life's unmanageable at any given moment in the day if I choose to let it be that way. You know, step two, we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the... admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and my life began... step two was came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I was insane. My behaviors were completely insane. I had to find a higher power. Step three, I found that higher power, and I turned my will and my life and my actions over to my higher power. Step four, I admitted, I wrote down all my character defects, and I had a ton of them, and they were not easy to deal with. Because I had, when I really examined my life, the way that I did it with my sponsor was how it's outlined in the book, but when I did that fourth column, he had me review my part in terms of the seven deadly sins, where I had been angry, slothful, envious, greedy. And when I looked at it from that perspective, it changed my whole outlook on my behaviors. You know, lust wasn't just about sexual stuff. I lusted after money, property, and prestige. Greed wasn't wasn't about being miserly. I was being greedy with my affections and my attentions towards my family, towards the people that love me. I talked about that with my sponsor, and we came up with a plan of action. You know, step six, I asked God to humbly remove those defects of character, and I started working on changing my behaviors. And I was given practical solutions on what that looked like. You know, I'd read the book and I'd go, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me. How do I practice these principles in all my affairs, especially at home with my wife? Because she does stuff that I don't like. You know, she doesn't dice onions properly. She doesn't, you know, there's things that really upset me. You know, you're supposed to slice a cantaloupe lengthways, not across the middle. What I was charged with was that I was to treat my wife like I would treat a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I was to come home and I was to be of service in my family. You know, if I came home and something was left out of place, I'd throw a tizzy fit. I was taught that if something's left out of place and it bothers me, it's my responsibility to take care of it. I was instructed to do the dishes, empty the dishwasher, make the bed in the morning, and not ask anything or let her know that I was doing it, just to do it because that's part of my contribution to that household. It wasn't my wife's job to do that. I lived in that household as well. And I started doing some of those little, I started changing some of those behaviors. I was told to put the cart back in the cart barn at the grocery store, to let somebody in on the freeway, not speed up and cut them off. I was given specific instructions on how to conduct my life from my sponsor. And it changed my life. You know, I started making the bed in the morning because I was the last one up. Chrissy would leave before I she taught preschool, and she'd get up earlier. So I'd make the bed, and about a month and a half later, she started bringing me coffee in bed. I never asked her to do that, but that was just from my act of kindness that I was instructed to do. I started getting some of that stuff back in return. And I started learning that practicing these principles in all your affairs isn't really that tough of a deal. It's actually a joy when you change your perspective. You know, I was taught that alcoholism is a perceptual, it's a disease of perception. You know, I always thought that I wasn't enough and that there wasn't enough. And when I set out to get all that stuff and I had everything that there was to get, it still wasn't enough. I had a perceptual problem. I had a spiritual malady. I had a disease, a soul sickness. I was always trying to fill that hole in my soul with stuff. And that wasn't what it was about. It was filling that hole. You know, God abhors a vacuum. The more you give, the more you get. You know, the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, the 11-step prayer in the 12 and 12, is really a paradox that kind of outlines what life is all about. You know, God grant that I seek to comfort than to be comforted. I seek to love than to be loved. But where there's darkness, may I bring light. It's the opposite. The opposite action gets the positive result. The more I give, my grandma used to tell me when I was a little kid, the more you give, the more you get. And I never believed that because I was greedy, and I just wanted. I just wanted. I didn't understand the concept that if I give something to somebody, I'll get something back in return. And every time I got something when I was a kid, it was never what I wanted anyway. You know, I never got the right stuff. And what I learned was it's not about what you're getting from anybody. It's about what you're giving to them. And if you're giving with a joyful heart and you're giving out of love, you know, what you get back tenfold. I started practicing some of those principles in my affair, and you know what? It absolutely works. It absolutely works flawlessly. That relationship that I almost walked out on with my wife that I was afraid to walk out on because I was losing my stuff, if I had walked out on that relationship, I would have missed out on the best thing in my life, and that's my wife and my relationship with her today. And, you know, we're good friends. We're best buddies, and we share really quality time together. It wasn't always that way. You know, it wasn't that long ago. I came home one day. This is probably four years ago. So I've been sober now, you know, 14 years or so. And I think things are going pretty swimmingly in our relationship. And so I come home from work, and she hits me with one of these questions that you just don't want to hear. And that was, are you my best friend? I said, yeah, baby, you're my soulmate. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. And she goes, well, I don't want to be your friend anymore because my other friends don't treat me like that. And I had to really take a look at my behavior. When I thought I was doing everything right, there was a lot of things that I wasn't doing right. I wasn't treating, if something didn't go right at the office, I'd come home and I'd carry that chip in my shoulder and I'd transpose it to my loved ones at home. I wasn't treating her like I would treat a friend. I had to take a look at my behavior. What's it like to be a friend? You know, would I want a friend to treat me the way I wouldn't hang around with me. And I had to take a look at that. That was a hard lesson for me to look at. But you know, I learned those tools in this program. I learned it from good sponsorship, by finding a guy that I could do business with, by trusting my higher power even when I don't think it's going to work out to my benefit, by having faith. You know, faith without works is dead. So just having faith doesn't do you anything unless you do the work. And to me, that work is a physical demonstration of what you're believed to be true. So by giving, I get back. I have some kids that are afflicted with the illness of alcoholism. And, you know, there's nothing I can do about that. They've got their own path. And they learn from a good alcoholic how to be an alcoholic. And what I'm hoping is that, you know, God doesn't have any grandkids. I'm hoping that they learn from this non-alcoholic today that's trying to work a program to the best of ability how to not be an alcoholic and how to live their life with some real joy and happiness. And it's hard work. You know, nobody said this was going to be easy. Easier, softer way would be just to go out there and drink. You know, I know what's going to happen if I do that. I'm going to end up dead. The only reason why I'm here today is because I had someone intervened. My higher power intervened in the way my life was miraculous. And I had no idea. He intervened with people that loved me. Loved me more than I loved myself. Loved me enough to put down appropriate boundaries to say, you can't do this anymore. And as a result, I'm somewhat sober. Somewhat sane. You know, I still have mental relapses from day to day. I'm not perfect at this program. I don't know that I'll ever achieve that goal. But every day I try to be the best person I can be. And when I wake up in the morning, I read page 86, 87, and 88 upon awakening. It gives me specific instruction on how to conduct my day. That I be divorced from self-thinking and self-seeking motives. That I always ask God for, I pray for other people. I don't pray for myself. When I'm agitated, I pause. You know, I didn't know what that meant. Agitated, you pause. When I'm agitated, I'm agitated. The last thing I want to do is pause. What my sponsor told me is that when I get off work and I'm coming home, that when agitated, pause means I stop at the bottom of the hill for 10 minutes, you know, have a cigarette, debrief. Remember what I'm coming home to. I'm not coming home to the enemy. I'm coming home to people that love me. When agitated, I pause. I do that every day. I debrief before I head up the hill. Because I don't want to bring that toxic stuff that happens at work home to my relationship. Because my family doesn't deserve that. That doesn't mean that we don't talk about problems that happen during the day at work because it impacts my wife as well. You know, the business stuff, I can't just let it go completely. But I don't bring it in like I used to, where I start throwing stuff around, kicking the dog and yelling at the kids. That's stuff I've learned in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life today far better than I ever imagined. When I see young people come into this program, I'm really encouraged. I'm encouraged because I didn't get this thing until I was well into my 40s. And I think about my biggest regret is all the time that was wasted. All the time that I wasted hanging out there and not knowing that there was a solution to my spiritual malady and my illness. A life-threatening illness. This disease kills people. And so anyway, I'm just grateful to be sober today. I hope I didn't bore you. I hope you heard something that you can use. Thanks for letting me share.